Welcome to Go West Young Podcast, the show about America's public lands and the outdoors. I'm Aaron Weiss at the Center for Western Priorities in Denver. We are in the office this week. I'm joined by our advocacy director, Jesse Prentice Dunn.
Good morning.
Our policy and communications manager, Lucy Livesay.
Hey, everybody.
And from CWP's West Slope headquarters in Ridgeway, Colorado, Deputy Director Greg Zimmerman.
Good to be here.
So Greg and Lucy just put out a fascinating report this week looking at the risk of wildfires on state and national lands across the West. We will talk about that in a minute, but I want to start first with national monuments. Late Sunday night, Juliet Eilprin with the Washington Post got a hold of that secret report that we've been talking about that Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke sent to President Trump, recommending changes, now we know, to 10 national monuments. So here's the very short version of what's in that report. Secretary Zinke wants to shrink at least 4 monuments, Bears Ears and Grand Staircase Escalante in Utah, Gold Butte in Nevada, and Cascade Siskiyou in Oregon. At 6 others, he's recommending changing what's allowed inside the monuments. That includes 3 marine national monuments, along with Oregon Mountains Desert Peaks and Rio Grande del Norte in New Mexico, and Katahdin Woods and Waters in Maine. So, Greg, I want to start with you. What is the first thing you noticed or that you thought when you read through this leaked report?
Well, it's not good. I think it would be generous to say this is maybe D-minus work for a high school freshman. I mean, look, there are significant factual inaccuracies littered throughout the report. There are pieces of the report that are just copied and pasted from other reports. And, you know, maybe worst of all, there's no specific recommendations for the president to actually act on. There's no maps and there's very little backup. So it's quite embarrassing for the secretary and for this Interior Department.
Not just sloppy. I mean, it's also just in places, Lucy, it's just factually inaccurate.
Yeah. So Senator Martin Heinrich from New Mexico with, you know, just a day of research identified multiple factual errors with the report. During an exchange with John Roos, the acting deputy director of operations at the Bureau of Land Management, at a Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee hearing, Senator Heinrich identified all these errors and walked through them with John Roos.
I was incredibly concerned in reading the report summary on the 2 monuments in New Mexico to note that there were more than a few simple factual errors included. For example, there's a claim that roads have been closed in Rio Grande del Norte National Monument. I confirmed with BLM staff that that's not accurate. And that ranchers have stopped ranching there because of those non-existing road closures. Also not true. The report says that the Oregon Mountains Desert Peaks National Monument is on or abuts the U.S.-Mexico border. That's also not true because on the recommendation of the U.S. Customs and Border Patrol, the boundary of the monument was actually established 5 miles north of the international border, actually north of New Mexico 9. Finally, it says that both proclamations need to be amended to protect hunting and fishing rights when nothing could be further from the truth. I have had the opportunity, in fact, to hunt everything from mern squail to javelina in the Oregon Mountains Desert Peaks National Monument. In addition, Peterson's Hunting Magazine just last month listed that monument as one of the top 10 public land destination hunts in the nation for quail. As for the Rio Grande del Norte, I confirmed this morning with the largest membership sportsman's organization in New Mexico that hunting and fishing access have actually improved post-monument designation, and that the monument even hosts a bighorn sheep hunt that did not exist before the monument designation. These are some pretty basic facts to get wrong. So I have to ask you, were the local BLM staff who actually managed these 2 monuments on the ground on a daily basis consulted by the Secretary's office regarding the facts on the ground in these monuments that they manage as part of that secretarial process?
Senator, I can assure you that
I myself and the Bureau of Land Management were not part of the writing of the reports. We did answer questions and provide data as necessary. I haven't seen the report, so I can't answer the questions up front, but I would be willing to take those questions and concerns back with me to the department and ask.
I would appreciate that. And so you were actually not asked to fact check that document before it was shared with the White House.
Correct, Senator. We provided information as requested, and again, that's the limit of our
involvement. So the Secretary's office might ask you a specific question, but you were not given an opportunity to review that document for accuracy.
Correct.
Okay.
So that is pretty harsh, to say the least.
And just to follow up on the Senator's last point about how his constituents are outraged about the errors in this report, I think one of the things most galling to me was how the Secretary summarily dismissed comments from the roughly 2.8 million people that commented on these the monument report. And so basically he broke us down into supporters and opponents and said that supporters of national monuments had no rational argument and that basically they should all be dismissed.
Which is to say dismissing the opinions of 2.6, 2.7 million Americans.
Right.
I do want to say something in, I guess, defense or clarification of John Ruse. John Ruse is not a political appointee. He's career BLM staff, being honest here, under questioning by the Senate, but I'll also, I suppose, in a way, throwing the secretary under the bus and defending his own organization.
And just to note, this is kind of the tip of the iceberg here. I mean, we were talking about monuments in New Mexico, but we've also heard reports of errors in the report about Cascade Siskiyou National Monument in Oregon, and surely more will follow. So this is not really a small issue.
Right. Obviously not limited to errors just in New Mexico. That Cascade Siskiyou thing you mentioned, there's just a pretty brutal editorial in the Mail Tribune out of Medford that I'm quoting here. For instance, the memo incorrectly says the original Cascade Siskiyou Declaration prohibited motorized transportation. It also refers to the need to protect hunting and fishing rights. Both hunting and fishing are allowed in the monument. And I suppose that's a good point as any to note that the Interior Department, the Secretary himself, has been really busy talking up hunting and fishing access over the last week, both before and after this leak, and I don't think that's an accident.
Don't think so.
I mean, Greg, would you be, you know, is it fair to call that sort of focus a red herring, if you will, for fishermen?
Absolutely. I mean, look, there's a key difference between words and actions, and we see Secretary Zinke very comfortable talking about the importance of hunting and fishing on America's public lands, but when the pedal hits the metal, he is advocating for one of the largest reductions of wildlife habitat in American history, the largest reduction of wildlife habitat in American history. So his actions and his words just aren't lining up here.
Guess maybe that explains why he installed Big Buck Hunter in the employee cafeteria at Interior this week. If you take away all that access, at least you've got video games, right?
That's right.
Jesse, what's next now that this report is out there but Interior really isn't talking about it?
So it's kind of a waiting game. There are a couple of ways this could unfold. You know, one, this report is so shoddy and so riddled with errors that Secretary Zinke could do the right thing and just retract it and basically say he needs to go back to the drawing board and preferably just leave it alone. The second has to do with President Trump and whether he wants to act on these recommendations. As you've noted already, there wasn't really anything specific or concrete or legally defensible with them, so it would kind of be a stretch for the president to actually go ahead and make some sort of executive action around eliminating monuments or changing the management plan. So he's busy with hurricanes and North Korea and all sorts of other things, so I'm not holding my breath for that.
All right, I want to move on from that dumpster fire of a report to actual fires burning across the West. Greg and Lucy are with us this week because they just released a big analysis in a report called Fire Lines. Greg, let me start with you. What's the big takeaway here?
Yeah, I mean, the big takeaway is that the risk of wildfire is approximately equivalent on U.S. public lands and state-owned lands. This is significant because some politicians in the West in recent years have made the argument that that national public lands are poorly managed and that's why they burn and therefore should be transferred to the states. And we just were curious, you know, what the data showed. And so what we did is we mapped out fire risk across the West. And what we found is that that there's no difference, that approximately 23% of national public lands in the West are at a high risk of wildfire, while about 22% of state-owned lands are at a high risk of wildfire. And what we found is that in many states, including in places like Utah, state-owned public lands actually have significantly higher percentage of lands at a high risk of wildfire than on the state-owned lands than there are on the national public lands within Utah.
So, Lucy, you've spent probably more time with this data than anyone else. Walk me through the methodology. This isn't some metric that we invented here to figure out wildfire risk.
No, so we relied on what's called the West-Wide Wildfire Risk Assessment Model, which was developed by the Oregon Department of Forestry for the Council of Western State Foresters. It's a well-regarded metric. It's called the Fire Threat Index, or FTI, which relies on the past occurrence of wildfire, local fuel types, meaning tree types and topography, weather regimes, stuff like that, to assign a likelihood to every acre in the West for the likelihood of a fire igniting on that acre. So we then took this map of the West where we had likelihood of fires igniting. Then we took roughly the top 25% of those acres and called that acres at a high risk of wildfire. And then we overlaid that map on top of land ownership maps, so who owns the land, states or federal agencies who manage our national public lands, and determined what the number of acres of each were at a high risk of wildfire. And then divided that by the total management acres to find the percent of each state and federally managed lands that were at a high risk of wildfire.
So obviously the percentage of land in each state that's at risk varies a lot because topography, geography, plants vary a lot. But I guess the bottom line is that what this turned up undercuts one of the biggest talking points that we see, Greg, from folks like Congressman Rob Bishop from Utah.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, look, fire doesn't know administrative boundary. So it doesn't matter whether it's federally managed lands or state managed lands or private lands. In areas that are fire prone, fires are occasionally going to happen. And look, Congressman Bishop and other members of the so-called Anti-Public Lands Caucus have been out there for a while now scapegoating public lands and public lands managers for the existence of wildfire in the West. Most people acknowledge and understand that it's ridiculous. There's nothing to it. Hopefully this data begins to move us away from this sort of ridiculous argument and towards, you know, an honest conversation in this country about how we address wildfire, the prevalence of wildfire, and, you know, the growing risk of wildfire to some Western communities.
So walk me through some of those recommendations that the report wraps up with. What can we do from a policy standpoint to start addressing this problem? Because it has been a really brutal year, especially in Montana and Oregon this year.
Yeah, and you know, I think like with anything, we should start with the lowest hanging fruit. And there have been bills in front of Congress, bipartisan, bicameral pieces of legislation for years now to address what's commonly referred to as the fire borrowing problem. This is a situation where the Forest Service, who manages the large majority of U.S. American-owned forests, the Forest Service can't treat wildfire like other agencies treat natural disasters. They're allotted a certain amount of money every year to fight fire. When that money runs out, they need to literally steal from other portions of their own budget to pay for fighting wildfire to pay for protecting communities from these incidents. And the result has been that with some frequency, they've had to take money out of budgets that would restore forests, limit the risk of future wildfires. It's a huge problem, and there's a very simple fix, which essentially just says, let the Forest Service treat wildfires like other natural disasters and don't make them steal money from their own budget to fund them. This is something that's very common sense. It's something that most elected officials support, and it's something that should get done tomorrow.
So there's the obvious congressional fix. Lucy, what else is in there in terms of next steps?
You know, so there's a lot of on-the-ground solutions too. So in terms of community actions to reduce wildfire risk in Western communities, the federal government and policymakers need to be incentivizing smart planning efforts on the ground. So, you know, fuel reduction, so on and so forth. Developing development plans for the wilderness-urban interface, where urban development is encroaching into wilderness areas. The federal government can take some actions to incentivize local communities to take action in their on the ground and help prevent wildfires in the West.
And you know, the other really interesting area in something that everyone likes to talk about is sort of developing this restoration economy. And it has been, you know, it's something that the Obama administration was very was interested in putting into action. And it's something you do see some bipartisan support for, but we need to have an honest conversation again about what developing a restoration economy looks like. And the reality with forests and with forest restoration is, you know, restoring forests doesn't require going in and taking out the biggest trees. You know, those are the ones that can withstand fire. It requires going in and, you know, occasionally clearing out some of the smaller underbrush. The problem is that it's very expensive, and there's not always markets for these sort of restoration byproducts. So one thing that Congress could be focusing its attention on is actually investing in markets to help stimulate a restoration economy across the West. This would help with rural economic development in places that have been struggling in recent decades, and it would also help with forest health.
So when we hear that word restoration or fuel thinning, I mean, does that mean one thing, or can that mean, you know, clear-cut logging to one person and going in and expensive underbrush removal, leaving the commercially valuable trees to someone else?
You know, I certainly am concerned that when you hear some politicians talk about restoration, they're talking about clear-cutting forests. That's not what when a forest economist or an ecologist talks about restoration, that's certainly not what they're talking about. They're talking about trying to return these forests to sort of historic fire regimes, so to speak. You know, these are places that have always burned naturally, and we've frequently removed fire from the system. And, you know, there are approaches to go in and, you know, and restore some of these areas. And, you know, and it's sort of where smart planning also comes in, what Lucy was talking about earlier. You know, we're not going to be able to implement these sort of restoration projects across, you know, hundreds of millions of acres across the West, right? We need to be prioritizing where we're doing restoration activities. And, you know, as new communities move into these fire-prone areas, we need to be figuring out what areas we need to be prioritizing to reduce the fire risk and to protect both property and also firefighters who are putting their lives on the line to fight fires across the West.
All right, last sciencey question, since you've got the forestry degree in the room here, Greg. Salvage logging after the fires. We're already seeing Greg Walden pitch the idea of going in and logging all of these trees that have come down in the Columbia River Gorge in particular. What does that do in terms of both the ecosystem coming back and in terms of future wildfire risk?
Yeah, so I mean, salvage logging is obviously a very controversial practice. And when it's conducted at a large scale, I mean, you have serious problems with erosion, and with, you know, the regeneration of of the next forest. So it's not something that should probably ever be implemented at a large scale. It's something that should be, you know, taken very, very seriously. And certainly there shouldn't be shortcuts and a lot of these guys talk about doing end arounds around environmental planning to get in there and do salvage logging. And it's not an answer to any problem that we currently have.
All right, we'll leave that there. Greg and Lucy, thank you so much for sharing that report. We've got a link to that report up in the show notes and at Western Priorities as well. All right, we always wrap up with a look back at this week in Western history. You guys remember the Unabomber?
Sure do.
Yep, 22 years ago, not all that far back in Western history. It was 22 years ago this week, the New York Times and Washington Post published the Unabomber's Manifesto. It was that 35,000-word essay. The Unabomber's string of bombings, his attacks, started in 1978. By the time the manifesto was published, he had killed 3 people, injured 23 others, and all of his targets were involved with modern technology in one form or another. The New York Times got that manifesto in the mail in April of 1995, and in it, he promised to stop bombing if the Times or the Washington Post published it. So the FBI and Attorney General Janet Reno both pushed for the publication, hoping someone would recognize the bomber's writing style or his beliefs. In that manifesto, he'd argued that technology had a destabilizing effect on society. He called for a return to, quote, wild nature. And the FBI's strategy worked. It was Ted Kaczynski's brother and sister-in-law who thought that manifesto sounded familiar. Now, David Kaczynski hadn't seen his brother in 10 years. He actually hired a lawyer to organize all the evidence and make contact with the FBI because that task force was so overrun with evidence, he was afraid that it would just get lost in the noise. And so he also wanted, of course, to avoid a Waco or a Ruby Ridge-style standoff in which his brother would have almost certainly died. So over 2 months, David worked with the FBI, and the FBI got a search warrant for Kaczynski's cabin in Lincoln, Montana. That was back in April 1996. The search warrant at the end was rushed because CBS News had learned Kaczynski's identity, and the FBI asked Dan Rather to hold off for 24 hours so they could get this warrant and serve the search warrant on the cabin. That cabin, when they got there, it had no electricity, no running water. It was basically the quintessential off-the-grid Montana cabin. It was in a place where no one would notice a Luddite who stockpiled bomb components inside. Now, contrary to, I guess, the mythos around Ted Kaczynski, he wasn't a hermit. He rode his bike into town regularly. He was well-known at the library, reading books in other languages. And folks in Lincoln, Montana, said that Ted Kaczynski's lifestyle wasn't all that unusual in the area. And Kaczynski would later on point out to development around Lincoln as a tipping point of sorts. Back during the summer of 1983, he said there were too many people around his cabin then, so he took a 2-day hike out to one of his favorite wild spots, only to find a road running through it. And after that day, he said, he would work on, quote, getting back at the system, revenge. So at Kaczynski's cabin, agents found that original typed manuscript of the Unabomber Manifesto. The most expensive investigation in FBI history had come to an end. Kaczynski went on to plead guilty in exchange for prosecutors taking the death penalty off the table. He's now serving a life sentence without the possibility of parole at the Supermax prison in Florence, Colorado. Kaczynski's cabin is on display at the museum in Washington, D.C. And everything that was inside the cabin, minus the bomb materials, of course, was auctioned off as restitution for his victims. A series of events that started with the publication of the Unabomber's Manifesto this week in 1995. That is it for this episode of Go West Young Podcast. If you have enjoyed this episode, please share it with a friend. Hopefully they will enjoy it too. And also, leave us a review on iTunes. That is the best way for new listeners to find us. You can send us an email, podcast@westernpriorities.org. You'll also find links to that Firelines report and some amazing fact-checking from Martin Heinrich there on national monuments. You can also read our Westwise blog on Medium, of course. Greg, Lucy, Jesse, thanks to all 3 of you for joining us today.
Thank you, Aaron.
And thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Aaron Weiss. We'll be back in a couple of weeks.